Welcome to the Combat Radio Network. This is Three Men and a Microphone, recorded inside the Iron Mike Studio, located in the Military Exchange on Route 332 in Canandaigua. Three Men and a Microphone is an opinion show based on the ins and outs, the news, politics, and scuttlebutt about town and the city of Canandaigua. Beautiful, historical Canandaigua, New York, where the hops grow higher, the grapes grow sweeter, and the sun always shines. I am your host, Corporal Tim Thornton, and this is Three Men and a Microphone. Introducing now, in the corner of Case's Mini Storage Plaza, wearing camouflage boxers and smoking a cigar, hailing from Canandaigua, New York, Corporal Tim Thornton's the all-new The Military Exchange. The Military Exchange is proud to present over 5,000 feet of pure 100% military. The Military Exchange is your source for all your military needs and proudly supports active reserve and former military, VFWs, legions, and leagues, Boy Scouts, Sea Cadets, Civil Air Patrol, and your family. Presenting cigars fresh from our plantation in the Dominica, collectibles, t-shirts, hoodies, and ball caps, rank and insignia uniforms for parade, security, and law enforcement, camouflage clothing, outerwear, wool pants, parkas, and field jackets, camping backpacks, tents, and sleep systems, vintage clothing and gear, Class A's, past and present, tactical and survival gear, antiques and airsoft, brand new and pre-enjoyed military camouflage and boots. Check out our military talk show at IronMikesMX.com. 5,000 feet to pure 100% military in Canandaigua, New York. Welcome to WOKR 1310 Civil War Radio with Armin Marinetti, and I'm Corporal Tim Thornton, and we're here today to talk about the Fifth Amendment. This is
Civil War Radio.
Civil War Radio, but however, I plead the Fifth, so that's it. The show's over. I'm not talking.
All right.
No, sir. How's it going, sir?
Not bad. How are you doing?
It's Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Happy Valentine's Day. Any festivities?
Yeah. We went out to one of our favorite local restaurants, Casa de Pasta, and had a nice dinner. It was very good.
No problem getting in?
No, because I was in the restaurant business for many years, so I've learned the patterns, and I avoid them. So I went Tuesday instead of Wednesday. Because the way I look at it, Valentine's Day is just a recognition on the calendar, but it's always in your heart. So you should make every day Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
And we went Tuesday night and had a real good, peaceful dinner. We were the first ones there, sat at the bar, had a glass of wine, and then dinner. It went really well.
So I have this thing. I've been trying to get into a certain section of a certain restaurant for as long as I can remember. Mm-hmm. And there was just the other day. We were there with another couple, and I don't know how many times I've told my wife, I go, when we walk in, be nice, look directly at the owner, don't be goofing off, and they offered us the good section.
Okay.
I know where the bad section is, if they think you're going to be trouble, or maybe you're unkempt or something, and I know where the other side is. Now, you're never going to get the back. The back is saved for big, huge parties.
Okay.
Right? I know it is. And then also the back. Now, I'm talking about this really huge, I'll just be honest, give them a plug, because I love the restaurant, Grand Super Buffet in Henrietta. It's Asian. So, you don't want to be on the right. The right's for the beginners. The left is okay. That's where I usually always wind up. But over the years, I've been kicked off to the right. Never, ever offered the middle until about a couple months ago. And my wife says, oh, no, we always eat to the left. And the guy said, well, all right. I couldn't believe I was, like, further behind. I didn't know what was going on. So Valentine's Day, you can almost get into the Asian restaurant a little bit more than the other restaurants. I don't know why. It wasn't like it wasn't busy, but it wasn't overflowing. So they finally gave us the middle. Couldn't believe I got the middle. And then my wife goes, well, I think the middle is reserved for a certain type of person. And I go, you obviously don't know the owner. And as people sat down and left, I pointed out every mix under the sky was in the middle, but they were all his best regulars.
Uh-huh.
They get the middle. They get the, I don't know about even the staff, if who's waiting on you is better or not, but it took at least 10 years, mm-hmm. and I finally arrived.
Good.
I was there. And then I eat so much, I can barely move getting out of there. But it's a great place to go.
Good, good. So I guess today, if we're following our schedule,
right.
we're going to be talking about the Fifth Amendment. And you've already pleaded the Fifth, which a lot of people know what that means. So you won't be saying too much, I guess. At least things that aren't incriminating. That's what. So let's begin with some of the highlights of the Fifth Amendment, because this amendment covers a lot of territory. One of them is that you can't testify against yourself, and that's where that term, I'm pleading the Fifth, where I can't incriminate myself under testimony, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in just a second. But the amendment, I'm going to read some of the actual language from the U.S. Constitution so that people are clear on what the Fifth Amendment, how it is written. It says, no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime, comma. Now, when they use capital there, they're not talking about money. They're talking about murder. Okay? So it's a capital offense. It's usually when you take another life. Okay? To continue. Unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury, comma. A grand jury is not the 12-person jury that we're accustomed to in court. It's a larger jury of our peers that see the evidence and decide whether there's enough there to take a person to court. Except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia, when in actual service in time of war or public danger. So that gives us the origin of military tribunals and courts. A person that is in the service of our country as a soldier or a sailor or a marine, they would go through the military court system instead of our federal court system if they commit a capital crime while they're serving our nation. Okay?
Right.
All right. Question? You look...
No, I was trying to think of the military term for...
Court-martial, would it be? I think...
Well, you're under... I can't believe I can't think of it. You're under a certain law that applies to the military, but it'll come to me.
You know, here's another common use of the Fifth Amendment. Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb. And that's that double jeopardy clause that we'll talk about a little bit more in just a minute. Let me finish reading because there's more to the Fifth Amendment as written. Nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. So that's the Fifth Amendment, and it covers several important legal issues.
What's the part about the just compensation?
We know that today is eminent domain. So that's a little bit down my list. All right, remember that thought, because
okay.
I'm going to try to go in order by the way the Fifth Amendment is written. So let me take this legalese and try to put it into terms that we're more familiar and comfortable with. So I already mentioned what capital crime refers to, and I already mentioned what a grand jury refers to. Moving down through the Fifth Amendment, we talked about twice put in jeopardy, tried for the same crime twice. So if you're acquitted of a crime by a jury, you cannot be tried for that same crime again. And in Thursday morning's Democrat and Chronicle, There is an article that is titled Judge, semicolon. Man can be retired on weapons count. So briefly, there was a situation where a gentleman was being chased by a police officer, turned and fired a gun, one shot. The police officer returned fire with four shots. I read the article and I had a little confusion, but the way I understand it is that the gun that the gentleman had was an illegal gun, wasn't registered. So he was found innocent of attempting to murder the police officer by a jury, which means that he cannot be tried again for attempted murder. But it looks like he's going to be tried for possession of an illegal handgun. So there is a local court case that is using one of our Fifth Amendment protections about being tried twice. So he can't be tried for attempted murder a second time because he's already been acquitted of that crime.
But he shot. He was running from the police.
Right.
He shot first at them.
That's the way it appears, yes.
They returned fire.
Yep.
And yet he's not. You know, right away, that sounds like they're more interested in letting that part go for, say, attempted murder. Because what they don't really want to fight is your right to possess a firearm anyways. Your First or your Second Amendment right to just have it.
Well, it looks like they're going to use the fact that he didn't have it permitted with a registration as a way to try to get him on some type of charge. So I think the Second Amendment here is not going to help him. I think the Fifth Amendment is helping him not to be tried a second time for attempted murder.
Right.
Okay. So he still is going to have some legal problems, but I'm guessing that the illegal gun possession charge is going to be a lot
right. It's more important lenient. For the state
yeah.
to push that.
Yes.
Because if that was the one that they dropped, well, then what? So we don't address the fact that he had a pistol to begin with.
Yeah.
Like that would mean that part's okay.
Yeah.
I guess. I don't know. I'm a little...
Me too. You know, I'm not an attorney. We just pretend to play attorneys here on the radio. But there's probably more to the case than we know because, you know, we can't sit in court and hear all the testimony. And I'm hoping that the jury knows a lot more than we do so they can make a informed, justified decision. So I thought that it was coincidental that showed up in the paper on Thursday, and here we are talking about it today. So now a couple more things about the Fifth Amendment that we're used to hearing. Can't testify against yourself. We're protected against self-incrimination. That's mentioned in the Fifth Amendment. So if I commit a crime and I get up there on the witness stand, I can say I plead the Fifth Amendment. You know, I'm not going to make any comments. In recent history, back in May of 2013, some people may recognize this name, Lois Lerner from the IRS. She was in front of a House committee, and she made an opening statement about her innocence, and then, almost in the same breath, said she's going to exercise her Fifth Amendment rights and not... Does you recall that
yeah.
at all?
Yeah, that was a big...
Yep. So that was back in May of 2013. And the people on the committee, Daryl Issa was one of the congressmen, and Trey Gowdy, they kind of were tweaked by that. And Trey Gowdy, who used to be a prosecuting attorney from South Carolina, said, ho, hang on a second. You can't do that. The fact that you already made an opening statement of your innocence is testimony. you already began testifying for yourself. Now you can't pick and choose when you're going to use the Fifth Amendment. It's either from the beginning of the proceeds throughout.
Where does it say that in the Fifth Amendment?
It doesn't, but I guess as a prosecutor, he used his experience as saying...
But, see, when I ask you this question later in when you're done, because I had a libertarian come in the store, and he made a statement about the Fifth Amendment that was shocked everybody in the store. People were pointing at him.
Okay.
So that actually is interesting that you... She's... I mean, there is... You read the Fifth Amendment. It doesn't say that you can't pick and choose. I mean, how many people do that? They start talking, right?
Yeah.
And they go, oh, wait a minute. I'm going down the wrong path. I plead the Fifth. I'm done.
Yeah.
I want my attorney, right?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, especially if the question arises that may be more incriminating than a previous question, right? Maybe the previous question was something as friendly as, so, you're... That suit looks very appealing on you. Where did you get that suit today? And you start answering honestly, well, I bought the suit over at blah, blah, blah. And then the next question is like, it hits you right between the eyes. Like, did you kill your wife?
You know? Well, by the way, that's the tailor is where we found the dead body.
No.
And we just established that you buy your suits there.
Yeah, so there's a connection.
Sorry, all the tailors in the area.
So another part of the Fifth Amendment that was mentioned is deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Now, the gentleman from Scope, they're often mentioning due process of law. So I wanted to look that up so I had a better understanding, and I got to tell you what I found. Due process of law, there is two separate but related distinctions. The first one is called procedural due process, which is addressing the legality of fair treatment and trial. That word legality showed up in the source that I used. It's lawcornell.edu. Legality means that the authorities have to follow certain rules as well when they try to prosecute a criminal. So you're entitled to a trial. You're not going to be browbeat, interrogated, water tortured, things along that lines. So there is a system in place that we're all entitled to, and that's called procedural. So think it's a procedure that has to be fair and legal to all of us. The second is what they call substantive due process. I might be pronouncing that wrong. Substantives, which means that they can't really abuse your rights because of your situation. And the best example I found was, say, for example, that I'm handicapped and I need a wheelchair. Well, they can't say, well, you got to go stand up on this witness stand, and the wheelchair, we're not going to accommodate for you. You have to get up there and be a witness in that stand on your own. And I may not have the ability to go up the couple steps to get into that chair because of my handicap. So they have to make accommodations. All right, so that's substantive, means based on my situation, they can't deprive me of a fair trial. So that's they can't beat me up as well. You know, that's considered...
Or detain you so you miss it.
Yeah. You know. Keep me awake. Keep me awake for hours and hours until I finally say, yeah, I did it, even though I may not have, but I want to just go to sleep. Okay? That right. type of thing. Deprive me of food. You know, they can't say we're not going to feed you until you confess, that type of thing. Okay? That's the substantive due process. Moving on, the last one is the one that you made a note of, Tim, about eminent domain. It states that private property can be taken for public use, cannot be taken for public use without just compensation to make it right. And the term eminent domain is something that we've heard recently right here in our own community. I'll tell you a story that's I'm more familiar with, and then we'll mention something about the birdcage or the right. on the lake there. My grandfather years ago had a grocery store in the city of Rochester, and it was right on the corner of Brown and Broad Street. Over the years, New York State decided that that would be a great location for a ramp to get onto 490 heading west to go out to Gates. So they, through the use of eminent domain, they bought my grandfather's grocery store. The ramp was built. But it's my understanding on the footprint where the grocery store was, now there's a little plaza that was built there as well that has a couple different stores, kind of a small convenience store, and also I think there's a liquor store in there as well. So the city of Rochester, New York State, they had the authority to say, we want that property for public use. And in this case, the public use was a ramp to get on 490. Here in Canandaigua, the land where the Canandaigua Resort, Finger Lakes Canandaigua Resort, the frame that's up there, I believe that land was also taken from the original owner by the eminent domain process, which stated that the city had a better use for that land. It was vacant at the time. So it causes a... Go ahead, Tim.
You just got to go back because it seems like... So they took the property from your grandfather.
Yes.
They built the ramp.
Yes.
But then later, they sold off a piece of it to make a...
convenience store. Yeah, another... Yeah.
Should they have given that land, part of that, at least part of it, back to your grandfather and said, hey, you know what? We didn't need as much as we thought, yeah. and we took it from you. I mean, does that mean that they paid him what they thought it was worth?
Well, there's a room for the argument. They did pay him something, but what they thought it was worth is where you start
I'm sure it was less than
sharpening your pencil. You know, and because they try to go by fair market value, which can be determined a number of different ways. Some can use tax assessments to try to come up with fair market value. Some can use its potential to earn income since it was commercial. So there's where the arguments begin. You know, it's worth more than that. Well, no, it's not. Not according to our calculations. Of course, the buyer is always going to try to keep it low. The seller is always going to try to ask for more. That's just...
Well, it angers me that they can take any land from anybody, even if they assess a value. But honestly, for them to turn around and make a profit and build a little plaza to sell it off without saying to your grandpa, by the way, well, this now is, we're returning this back to you.
Yeah.
And in compensation, we'll just build the plaza part. But they didn't do that, of course. They made a profit and sold it.
That I don't know. I know that...
Well, they had to make a profit.
They probably...
got it for... Well, I got you right. We don't really know what they paid.
Yes.
So...
Yes.
Yeah.
They probably got their money back.
Well, I would
maybe
bet.
More.
Yeah.
I know that my grandfather, he was getting on in years, so my uncle... they found another location on Ridgeway Avenue towards the old Aquinas Stadium, and they bought the location and put their grocery store there. So they didn't get out of the business. They relocated, and they used some of the proceeds from this eminent domain.
I can almost picture where that is.
Right on the corner of Ridgeway and Ramona, near the brick place there. There used to be Gwetty's Market is the name of the grocery store, but they're gone now. My uncle's gone. He's passed on.
You know what I think I've heard is the original eminent domain? Is that they took General Lee's land, his farm, plantation, away during, of course, I assume after the Civil War, or during it.
Okay.
And that became the the famous cemetery.
Arlington Cemetery. Yeah, yeah.
So, but it was done through eminent domain, and I've heard that that's the first one, the first time they really used it.
I didn't know that.
Which I don't know if I believe that part, but if it is, and you know, and how odd to realize that that was, and I think that was the whole point. General Lee supposedly wasn't for the Southern policies, but he knew he was fighting because they were going to take his farm anyways.
Yeah.
But also, it seemed like they took it away out of punishment, too.
Yeah.
For because he was a favorite general.
Yes, he was. And I think he was a classmate with Ulysses S. Grant, if I'm not mistaken.
A lot of people growing up, I used
at West
always,
Point.
West Point, that most of the Southern generals were the best of the generals.
Yeah.
But I don't know if I well, it's sort of because we lost a lot of Union generals. I mean, that's way off track, but it's fun.
So, I mean, there's I apologize because, as I told you when I first came in, I'm going to be tight on time today. So there is more information with regards to the Fifth Amendment, and I don't feel like I'm giving it a fair shake.
I got to ask you the Fifth Amendment thing that I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
All right, so this gentleman comes in the store, and he's a soldier, just got back from, you know, Afghanistan or Iraq, and he we're all just in here, a bunch of guys talking. And they were these guys looked at him like he spoke pure heresy.
Okay.
Not exactly sure I'm going to repeat it right, but I'm pretty sure I got it like this. Somehow, everybody's always talking about self-defense, Second Amendment, you know, the right to defend your castle. So this guy says, you know, as everybody else was saying, well, if someone broke into my home, you know, you better drag them all the way in, because if they're half in the window and half out and you shoot them and they fall out, you're probably going to get in a lot of trouble. So drag them all the way in. Don't let them live. You shoot them, right, so that there's, you know, dead man tell no tale. Some weird stretch of the conversation. And ask anybody. We have great conversations in here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even have to be a part of it. I love the way they go. So this guy, being a libertarian, says, if I had to defend my house against an attacker or an intruder,
mm-hmm.
not only would I shoot him dead, but I would plead the Fifth and never, ever report it.
Mm-hmm.
And they just, everybody looked at him and goes, would you have to tell on yourself? Well, at what point, because you're, so say you shot someone, or say it was murder, at what point do you really not have to even, I mean, you're obviously legally you're supposed to report it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to plead the Fifth anyways, well then why even report a crime that would incriminate you, right?
Boy.
Isn't that amazing twist of a way to think about it?
Again, I'm going to go back to what we said earlier. We're not attorneys.
And, we don't even play attorneys.
No, and I'm
there's
sure
no legal advice
there's here. More than a bunch of different crimes that would be committed by not reporting a dead body in your living room. I don't know what they are, but I'm sure there's, you know.
Oh, it's all a crime.
Yeah.
Right, but at what point do you, like before, where do you start the Fifth?
Yeah.
Because if I call in to report it, right?
Yeah.
Let's say it's a crime. Maybe that's more what he meant. Or you know it's going to cause trouble for you. So I'm not even going to report it. I'm taking the Fifth right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. I don't know. I really don't. That'd be interesting. I'd hate to be in that situation.
See, there's two things about libertarians that I think I've learned.
Yeah.
At first, it sounds like an awesome place to hang out.
Yeah.
But I've coined this phrase. Usually, I think it's about Vermont. In Vermont, they're so libertarian that they're so far to the right that they're left again.
Yeah.
And sorry, Vermont. I love your state, by the way. And the other one is, I had a friend who knows me really well, and I said, you know, I think I might be a libertarian. And he goes, if you really get into them, you'll find that you're not.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, I would never, ever think that we shouldn't defend our borders or not interfere overseas for something that matters to America or the freedom of others. And a libertarian stops at the borders.
Yeah.
So anyways,
Yeah, there could be a fine line between libertarianism and anarchy, too. I mean, we have to have a set of rules. The real issue is what can we agree on? So before I forget, because people would be upset, another thing that came out of the Fifth Amendment to our U.S. Constitution is the Miranda rules. Do you recall the Miranda rules?
Yeah.
Well, quickly, Miranda versus Arizona in 1966. Gentleman was arrested. He was held, and he confessed to a crime. And they said that the reason why he confessed is because he was being deprived of things such as sleep, sitting down. So they kind of misused or abused this gentleman until he finally confessed. So from that, we get our Miranda rights, where the police officers have to tell you, and I'm going to paraphrase this, is that if you get arrested, you have a right to remain silent. Anything you say can and may be used against you in a court of law. You have a right to an attorney, and if you can't afford one, one will be appointed. So you recall hearing those? You almost every police show.
Oh yeah.
You know, Hill Street Blues, Blue Bloods, all those police shows. You know, you hear that. Well, that came from that case, the Miranda versus Arizona case. So he did end up going to jail, and it wasn't because of his confession, because he was retried. And the confession wasn't allowed as evidence, but he was convicted of the crime and sentenced to 20 to 30 years in prison. So that's really all I have time for today. And I apologize for being so short, but I'm hoping maybe the guys from Scope, because the due process thing is always a big question in their discussion of our Second Amendment rights. You know, we can't just come and take our right to defend ourselves away without having a legal, that's that legality. The authorities have to have a legal reason to do it. So, and it's interesting about the libertarian, because I've gone to a couple of different meetings with libertarians, and I agree with much of what they say. But then I do see that we need a civil society. That's why we call this Civil War Radio. We have to be able to behave like mature adults so that we can make good decisions. Too often, when you get into the mud and the name-calling, as a good friend of mine says, is that never wrestle with pigs, because you will get dirty and they like it.
So they like it. Yeah.
So that's all I got for today, Tim.
Yeah, I had to remind myself. I have a friend of mine that comes in here, and he's very liberal, and I like this guy. He's a young guy, and I do like him. I think everything else, except for his politics, I like how he conducts himself. I like his. The things he does for the community. Mm-hmm. I like the way he raises his family. I like the way he talks to me. We hang out. But talk politics, and I am just
flip a switch. Yeah.
And I don't even want to be near him when he talks. But in person, we're both very respectful. And right away, I start to forget, this is the guy who online, he's just berating any of my ideas or my beliefs. But you just sometimes just got to remind yourself that this is politics.
Yeah.
And you have to remember this person is also a good person too.
Yeah.
And I always go back to what I think is going to be the future. When I was a kid, I remember someone saying, I'm not going to get gas there. That's a Catholic gas station.
Wow.
And I was so...
Never heard of that.
I couldn't even understand it.
Yeah.
I remember telling my dad. And so, anyways, I think in the future, people are going to shop or not shop or friend and befriend based on your politics now. Mm-hmm. And walk around with that badge on your business door or your jacket. Hmm. And with the invention of Facebook and the internet, you know, you could have the oddest of beliefs, and you could get online and find 12 other friends and only associate with those 12 friends and not even feel like an odd person because of the internet.
Yeah.
So those people don't even walk around and feel odd anymore because, are you kidding me? My buddy in Idaho, I made up a state, Iowa or Idaho, they believe like me. Mm-hmm. So they don't even feel odd anymore.
Yeah.
But, so anyways, you know, depends on whether you're going to shop at the Republican gas station or the liberal gas station.
It sounds like we're kind of regressing. And going back to your friend, you remember the old story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde? Sometimes I have friends that you hit that wrong topic and they turn into a monster. It's like, they're not going to listen to anything. They're going to raise their voice and everything gets turned upside down. So.
You know, right. In the old days, you didn't talk politics, you didn't talk religion, and maybe the old timers got it.
Yeah.
But that's not what we do here.
We talk
the
like adults.
Yeah, like adults.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Herman.
Yeah. I'm sorry I got to leave so early. I got to get to the other side of Victor.
Honey, how many times do I have to move your old army bag? It's taking up too much room in the closet.
It's a duffel bag. It's full of my old uniforms.
And are you going to wear them again?
Yeah, maybe. Someday.
Uh-huh. And what size do you wear now?
Whatever.
Honey, why don't you take them to Military Mike's? You're certainly there enough.
It's Iron Mike's, and at least he doesn't make comments about my weight.
Bring your old military gear down to Iron Mike's Military Exchange. They'll turn your old uniforms, gear, and military collectibles into cash. So if you drug it back from overseas and it doesn't fit your motif, we want it. Iron Mike's wants your Class A's, Alphas, Hammies, Fatigues, Utilities, Digis. We want your Deuce gear, Molly gear, Alice gear, Web gear. Bring in your Poly Pros, new boots, used boots. Heck, if it's green, camouflaged, or digital, we want it. Give it a good home. Use pre-enjoyed. Iron Mike's has a bin for it. Iron Mike's buys, sells, and trades. Iron Mike's Military Exchange, located in Canandaigua, New York. Check out all their newly acquired items at militaryexchange.co.
And now, a moment of bliss, courtesy of Iron Mike's Military Exchange and Camping Supply.
My Wooby, you swept me off my feet and put into my heart such fiery heat. At first sight, I would not have known the kind of warmth and protection I'd be shown. You've helped me through the good and bad. For being issued you, I am so glad. You are my warmth and soulmate, and we both know that it's fate. Forever, I will hold you tight. Because of you, I know I'll never be cold. I'm yours, and you are mine. Forever and ever will be just fine. And on the eighth day, God created the poncho liner, and the infantry was very thankful.
The American-made military-issue poncho liner, available in assorted colors along with a USGI poncho to create a ranger bag. Available at Iron Mike's Military Exchange, Route 332, Canandaigua. Visit online at ironmikes.co.
Welcome back to Civil War Radio, and I am your host, Corporal Tim Thornton, and I'm here today. This is Scopes Hour, Shooter's Committee on Political Education. And we're here today, and we're going to talk about mass shootings and a mental health disgrace. In lieu of the shooting this week in Florida, and, you know, it doesn't have to be said, but our hearts break for the families, for the children, and you just sit there and you got to wonder what can be done. The federal bureaucracy is anti-patient, anti-family, anti-medical care reform is essential. This article is by Tim Murphy. These past few months have brimmed with tragedy. Americans are struggling to make sense of horrific acts of mass violence like the August shooting on live television in Roanoke, Virginia, and last week's college campus shootings in Roseburg, Oregon. And now the shooting in Florida. We all know how this plays out in Congress. A moment of silence on the House floor and a fraternal feeling of melancholy when the flag over the Capitol is lowered to half staff. But that moment of silence will not heal the hearts of those who lost a loved one. And it will not stop the next tragedy. Here and now, we need action. We need real change. That's why I've authorized the Helping Families and Mental Health Crisis Act. The bill focuses resources and reform where they are most needed to foster evidence-based care, fix the shortage of psychiatric hospital beds, empower patients and caregivers under HIPAA privacy laws, and help patients get treatment well before their illness spirals into crisis. As chairman of the House Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee, I led a congressional investigation into our failed mental health system after the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. Again, this article is written by Tim Murphy. What we found was shocking and disgraceful, a wasteful federal bureaucracy that is anti-patient, anti-family, and anti-medical care. The federal government has more than 112 programs that deal with mental health in one way or another. Yet a person with serious mental illness is 10 times more likely to be in a prison cell than a psychiatric hospital bed. In 1955, there were over 558,000 inpatient psychiatric beds in the United States. Today, there are fewer than 45,000. The severe shortage to decades-long deinstitutionalization that began in the civil rights era. But it has been exacerbated by a medical reimbursement rule known as Institutions for Mental Disease Exclusion, which prohibits federal matching payments for inpatient care at psychiatric hospitals with more than 16 beds. My bill moves away from the arbitrary 16-bed cap and establishes a clinical standard for patients with serious mental illness. We know that families of the mentally ill are the frontline care delivery team. We also know that those with serious mental illness frequently have chronic diseases like diabetes. Yet federal privacy laws routinely thwart efforts by families to obtain critical information about a sick family member, or even to share that information with the treating physician. This is one reason why the seriously mentally ill die 25 years sooner than the rest of the population. Under my bill, minor adjustments to HIPAA will allow the doctors to share with a known and trusted caregiver the medical diagnosis, prescriptions, and time and place of appointments. Sharing this minimal yet vital information will save lives. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, those with mental illness in treatment are 15 times less likely to engage in an act of violence than those who go untreated. Many states are adopting court-supervised treatment programs, known as assisted outpatient treatment, for those who, by the very nature of their illness, are unable voluntarily comply with necessary medical and psychiatric care. A 2005 New York study found that this model reduced rates of imprisonment, homelessness, substance abuse, and costly emergency room treatment for chronically mentally ill participants by upward of 70%. It has also reduced annual Medicaid costs by more than 40% for participants. According to a recent Duke University study, my bill promotes alternatives to long-term inpatient care by helping states fund these innovative approaches to community-based treatment. Many families who do successfully arrange for care still face federally funded protection and advocacy lawyers fighting against their efforts to get their mentally ill loved ones to treatment. These lawyers effectively work to get patients out of life-saving care and abandon them upon release. My bill returns the program to its original function of preventing abuse and neglect of the seriously ill. This bill also requires psychiatric hospitals to establish clear and effective discharge plans to ensure timely and smooth transition from the hospital to appropriate post-hospital care and services, emphasizing continuity of care. It would be impossible to enact meaningful reforms without overhauling the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. The relatively obscure federal agency charged with overseeing the lion's share of mental health programs, in a scathing report released in February, the Government Accountability Office found that despite SAMHSA and its $3.6 billion annual budget, coordination related to serious mental illness that has been largely absent across the federal government. Rather than focus on the millions of Americans with serious mental illnesses such as schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, SAMHSA spends billions on behavioral wellness programs for those without a mental illness. Incredibly, SAMHSA even funds the government anti-treatment industry, which encourages mental health patients to stop taking medications. My bill focuses resources on clinical programs with a proven record of effectiveness, such as the Recovery After Initial Schizophrenia Episode Project, an adolescent early intervention program, and the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. The legislation also launches a new early childhood grant program to provide intensive services for children with serious emotional disturbances in an educational setting. A cornerstone of my reform package is new executive branch leadership. By establishing a new position, an assistant secretary for mental health and substance use disorders, we can ensure that recipients of federal mental health block grants apply evidence-based models of care, and that dollars are optimized to help patients rather than the bureaucracy. The Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act has been a grassroots effort, but despite garnering more than 130 bipartisan co-sponsors, as well as support from families and almost every major police, sheriff, and mental health organization in the country, the bill is still blocked by a vocal minority in Congress. Protecting the failed status quo, no more moments of silence. The time to act is now. Mr. Murphy, a Republican, is a U.S. representative from Pennsylvania and a psychologist in the Navy Reserve Medical Service Corps. Look him up, send him an email, tell him what you think, and then share that with your local representative. This has been a Scope Moment, Shooter's Committee on Political Education, and we hope you enjoyed it, and we hope you come back next week, and the boys will be here, and we'll talk live more about this subject as it applies to our Second Amendment.
The Military Exchange.
Welcome back to the Military Exchange Talk Show. I'm your host, Corporal Tim Thornton. U.S. troops told to run, hide, and fight after Brussels terror attacks. Brussels joined the list of places Wednesday where U.S. troops can't go without a general's approval. And the advice from the command on what to do if caught up in an attack came down to this: run, hide, and then fight if necessary. The warnings came after an Air Force Lieutenant Colonel and four members of his family were injured in the nail-laden bomb attacks Tuesday on Brussels Zaventem International Airport and at the Malbeek stop on the Brussels subway near the U.S. Embassy and the headquarters of the European Union. Air Force spokesman said they could not immediately give an update on the conditions of the officer and his family members due to privacy reasons, but initial reports said the injuries don't appear to be life-threatening. The service said that the officer was assigned to Joint Force Command Brunsum, a NATO command in the Netherlands, which provides support to the mission in Afghanistan. Tuesday's attacks claimed by the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, killed at least 31 and wounded more than 260, according to Belgium federal prosecutor Frederick Van Loo, but he warned that the list of casualties could grow. Addressing the Corps of Cadets at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point Wednesday, Defense Secretary Ashton Carter said that the Brussels attacks and the injuries to the Air Force family would not deter the U.S. from its commitment to destroy ISIS. The terror bombings were a grim reminder of how serious are the dangers we face. Civilization and our country face, said Carter, who cited the military family that was affected by these attacks. Carter said the Pentagon will do everything we can to protect the Air Force family injured in Brussels and all military families against future attacks. He added that no attack will shake our resolve to accelerate the campaign to defeat the extremist group. All the service branches, the Defense Department and the State Department, renewed and tightened travel restrictions and warnings on the ISIS threat throughout Europe and in Turkey. For U.S. citizens and the more than 60,000 U.S. military personnel in Europe, with special emphasis on the upcoming Easter holiday weekend, the recent attacks that we have seen in Brussels and Turkey really highlight that we are facing a significant and persistent threat throughout the theater, said Robert Balzerzak, Deputy Chief for Anti-Terrorism for the U.S. Army Europe. The response of troops caught up in a terror attack really depends on the situation, Balzerzak said in a statement. In the event of an active shooter, the DOD stresses to run, hide, and then fight if necessary. Perhaps most important, if host nation or U.S. security is responding, be very cooperative with the law enforcement and careful you do not make yourself a suspect. Shortly after the Tuesday attacks, U.S. European Command put an indefinite ban in effect on travel by military personnel to Brussels as a precautionary measure to keep personnel and families safe, specifically unofficial travel to Brussels. Leave, Liberty, and Special Pass is prohibited until further notice. Shortly after the Tuesday attacks, U.S. European Command put an indefinite ban in effect on travel by military personnel to Brussels. As a precautionary measure to keep personnel and families safe, specifically unofficial travel to Brussels, leave, Liberty, and Special Pass is prohibited until further notice. The command said those on official travel or emergency leave to Brussels will also require the approval of the first general flag officer in the traveler or sponsor's chain of command. Similar restrictions are already in effect for travel to Turkey. For those personnel assigned to NATO headquarters at Mons, south of Brussels, the latest restrictions came on top of increased security that was already in place following the terror attacks in Paris last November. One family member told military.com that stronger gate security, altered access points, and added security patrols are visible, but otherwise life is going on as usual. Other changes have also been put in place, she said, such as a decision to move both an annual school prom, traditionally held in a nearby chateau, to the base club, as well as the annual high school graduation ceremony. Periodic travel restrictions have become the norm for military personnel in Europe in recent years to lower the risk posed by terrorism following incidents in which U.S. personnel were targeted or found themselves caught up in a terrorist attack. In 2011, an attack on a group of airmen at the Frankfurt Airport in Germany killed two troops. And last August, an off-duty airman traveling by train to Paris was credited with the help of two friends with subduing a gunman. Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, the USARA commander, said, "The reality of these attacks highlights the need for us all to be vigilant. I urge everyone to be aware of their local security situation. Listen to AFN, Armed Forces Network, or local news outlets and ensure you are signed up for the emergency communication system. Ad hoc with your local garrison so that you may have the latest updates. If you see something that you think is suspicious, there are many different vehicles you can use to report," Hodges said. iReport is a downloadable app that you can get on your smartphone, which would make a quick way to report any suspicious activity, or you can go online to any one of the USARA web pages to iWatch. It's the same mechanism. The travel alert put out to all U.S. citizens by the State Department after the Brussels attacks warned of the potential risks of travel to and throughout Europe. It said, terrorist groups continue to plan near-term attacks throughout Europe, targeting sporting events, tourist sites, restaurants, and transportation. U.S. citizens should exercise vigilance when in public places or using mass transportation. In addition to avoiding crowded places, U.S. citizens should exercise particular caution during religious holidays, and at large festivals or events, the alert said. So the question is, should our military personnel, U.S. troops, families stationed abroad and overseas, or here in the U.S. of A., run, hide, and fight? Well, certainly a family member, I think, could follow those directions. But here's a little bit more in depth of what you should do from a former Navy SEAL. Run, hide, fight, former Navy SEAL reveals how you can survive a terrorist attack. This guest post was written by former Navy SEAL and JSOC operator Clinton Emerson. Visit his site, Escape the Wolf, for more tips. Clinton is also the author of the New York Times bestseller, 100 Deadly Skills. They were business travelers, colleagues, students, daughters, sons, fathers, and mothers with so much life ahead until their ordinary evening, and this is in reference to the Paris attack, was shattered by predators. Sadly, our world isn't getting any safer. How can a normal person be prepared for monsters and an unpredictable terrorist attack? You can get inside the bad guys' heads. If you understand what might happen, then you can take action to be prepared. Highly skilled operatives or violent nomads possess knowledge that can't be divulged without severe risk to public safety. But they also possess plenty of life-saving information that can be shared. Let's take a look at the basics. Research. Know where you're going and what you're getting into. Learn as much as possible about where you're going in advance. Conduct research on the internet. Ask contacts, friends, and others who are based at your destination. Up your total awareness. Determine how safe the overall situation is. Research the local culture, social protocols, and cultural etiquette. Make sure your personal mannerisms and gestures allow you to fit in. Understand the third-party threats. Make a simple plan. Plan scenarios and your actions ahead of time. That way, you'll be more likely to take the right action in a stressful, time-crunched situation when not all of the facts are available. Have an exit strategy at all times. Plan this in advance before heading into any situation. Take basic precautions. First and foremost, keep your eyes off of your phone. Keep your head on a swivel. Your senses will keep you alive. The latest post on Instagram, not so much. Have someone translate news and media so you are always aware of what's going on in the country you're visiting. Talk to locals about which places to avoid. Terrorists love high-profile targets, transportation hubs, tourist sites, government districts, and national monuments. Their goals are mass casualties and attention. Avoid unattended bags left at mass transit station or stops, or unattended bags left on buses, trains, etc. Report them. Stay away from passengers who wear oversized clothing, dress inappropriately for weather conditions, France train attacker, or have really bulky carry-on baggage or luggage that is stained or giving off strange odors, Russian airliner bomb. The same goes for people on the street who match these criteria, especially if they have a nervous stare and are sweating profusely. Don't assume checkpoints are always legit. Criminals and others can misrepresent authorities. Plan your routes. Know where you're going. Always pay attention to your surroundings. Determine in advance the trigger that will cause you to take action for potential risks you've identified. A couple of specific life-saving tactics from the book 100 Deadly Skills. Surviving an active shooter. Run in a zigzag pattern from cover to cover. It's harder to hit a moving target. If you can't run, then hide. Silence cell phones, lock a door, or create a barricade if possible. Call for help. Draw blinds or curtains. Keep eyes on the shooter. Squat or kneel if bullets are flying. Most ricocheting bullets follow the path of the floor. At a last resort, fight. Act aggressively and violently. Throw anything available at the assailant. Work as a team with others. Surviving a grenade attack. Although these attacks are typically unanticipated, still, try to react with the following. If the grenade lands within 3 steps of your position, get behind cover. If no cover is available, take 2 big steps away from the blast and fall to the ground. Assume proper body posture. With your feet towards the grenade, legs crossed, belly and face down, elbows in tight, hands over ears, and your mouth open. The most basic practices can be the biggest lifesavers.
Thank you for listening to the Combat Radio Network.
on Channel 1310 WOKR. This has been the Civil War Radio, and coming up next, Three Men and a Microphone. You can check us out every Saturday morning at 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. and every Sunday afternoon, an encore performance, 2 in the afternoon to 4 p.m. Thank you again for listening to Combat Radio Network, brought to you by the Military Exchange in Canandaigua, where they are 5,000 feet of pure 100% military.